Mark, O mighty one, our sacrifice begins. We commence.
Welcome to Spellbird, a podcast about the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. It's time to party like it's 1974.
Ha ha ha! You think you can silence your listeners by only reading two or three paltry emails per episode?
Oh, sorry, Great Cesar Khan. We didn't mean to.
Silence! Don't grovel like a Hobbs. Get thee to the mailbox and summon some emails.
Well, folks, you heard the man. I guess this week we'll be dealing with our overflowing mailbag. I'm Judge Jeff, and with me are my illustrious co-hosts, Judge Jen.
Good evening.
And Judge Julian.
Hello.
But before we get on with it, let's take a quick trip to the tavern.
Welcome, friends.
I only had one drink to calm my nerves.
Innkeeper, a drink of your most expensive.
Tavern Talk.
All right, here we are in Tavern Talk, where we're going to all just kind of chat about the gaming that we've been up to for the last week or so. Julian, what's been going on with you, my friend?
We had a Game Hole Con in Madison, Wisconsin, just a couple weeks ago. Had a blast. It was great to see old friends. The Brendans, the Dougs, the Forrests, the Reeds, even Scott Swift in a special outfit, which he usually wears, complete with like purple three-piece suit and platforms. So that's always fun.
Yeah, snazzy.
There were people there that I didn't even get to see. I mean, it was we were having too much fun, perhaps. It was a great con, and I'm not going to round the whole thing up. But I ran some Mutant Crawl Classics as well as some American Survival Guide with Reed. And then I actually had Mr. Hobbs play in my weird DCC Mutant Crawl mashup game that we ran. And that was pretty strange and fun. And then, that actually turned out well. And he I think both of his characters survived, I'm unhappy to say. And. Then we topped it off with a little Nowhere City funnel adventure, my newly published funnel adventure, which is about half published right now. We did that, and Valerie played in that game. And so that was fun to have her at the table, too. I got to pick her brain about some GM secrets. So that was, excuse me, judge secrets. Maybe the highlight was playing Dogstorm with Doug.
Not played Dogstorm before?
I hadn't. I've seen it many times, but I hadn't actually played it. And I know that I've harped on this on the internet, but let's just say Clint Bohady has a pretty unique and probably borderline sketchy legality approach to how he hurls the Dogstorm when it comes to his turn. That's all I'm going to say. But it was an epic game with the Minneapolis Posse and Doug. And I think actually Doug won when Trevor killed all of us at the end and left one Doug guy as the only survivor. So that was a lot of fun.
Nice.
Cool. Hey, Julian, how did for your DCC-MCC mashup, how did letting people choose between a mutation and an artifact, how did that aspect of it go?
You know, I didn't really let them choose. I just handed people random stuff. I had a bunch of mutations and one artifact. And I think Jason got the mutation, the artifact. Yeah. Anyway, I didn't really do that. So that's a short answer.
Gotcha. Fair enough.
But they found artifacts and then failed to be able to use them because that's, you know,
That's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
You mentioned Nowhere City Nights. Funnel is part published?
So I have paper copies, and I sold a couple at the more than a couple, but I sold a couple at the convention, but then, and I still have a few more, but we're still in the process of getting all the PDF loaded to, you know, the Goodman Games site and everything else. So it'll be available shortly. It's a funnel adventure, and it is, you know, kind of half reality show, half treacherous backstabbing PvP nightmare. So,
like the rest of your your Nowhere City Nights.
Yeah. Like most of my games, Cunning Crown of Magiscar, you know, I do enjoy that thing.
Nice.
That's great. So Jen, what have you been up to?
Not nearly enough gaming. We did have the Halloween game day at Dungeon Games out here. Just a couple days after we recorded that last episode, by the way, where we had the nice debate about patrons and clerics and are they really any different. And so that actually came up while I was in the midst of running the Sinister Sutures of the Sempstress. And again, the next game I ended up playing while Bob ran John Hook's Halloween Adventure. I apologize, the title is not available off the tip of my tongue because I did not run it and commit it to memory, kind of the way it goes. But I said, give me something that I don't normally play. So I ended up with a chaotic cleric who started with 4 whole points of luck. And I was trying to use my patron trying to use my deity as a patron. And by the end of the game, I think I had 17 or 18 points of deity disapproval.
Ooh.
So it was fantastic.
That's amazing. I think when you get up to 18 points of deity disapproval, the only thing to do is then to ask for divine aid.
Well, no, 10 of that was from asking for divine aid and rolling something, you know, illustrious like a 2.
That's great.
But yeah, not nearly enough gaming, but still plugging away on editing on stuff that I don't know if I'm allowed to mention yet. So I must move on.
Okay, cool. And in my last couple of weeks here, my buddy Andrew Sternick, we had the second session of his campaign that he's got going. And it's very much kind of in the vein of Daniel Bishop's kind of fairy wood style adventures. It's pretty cool. My 4 sisters, who are my 0 level characters who I played so far, have all survived. But I've leveled up one of them, and she is this kind of badass 16-year-old girl who went missing for a year. And when she came back, she had a preserved aardvark's heart tied around her neck on a chain, which was my random item that I got from Doug Kovacs's D200 nice. Random item chart. But I decided love that she, when she came back from missing for a year, she had that around her neck, and she's convinced that she was captured and taken off to Elfland for that year. And she's certain that preserved aardvark heart is some kind of a token of some sort that protects her or has some kind of mystical power. We'll see how much Andrew buys into that. That's the story I'm creating for my character. And so that was fun. And then we also ended up playing my buddy Hoy. He did a game for the meetup group. He ran Daniel J. Bishop's Creeping Beauties of the Wood. So lots and lots of foresty, fey kind of action with my DCC lately. And nice. So we did the first session of that, and he's going to do kind of a multi-session version of Creeping Beauties of the Wood, enjoying that. And I don't know that this is really going to happen, but I will know by late November, early December. But I was also just approached yesterday, as a matter of fact, do you guys know the TV show Cake Boss?
Yeah.
Well, Cake Boss has approached me via my meetup group and asked if I might be interested in appearing on an episode of Cake Boss where they make a gargoyle cake and deliver it to our meetup group while we're playing games. So me judging DCC might end up on an episode of Cake Boss.
I am throwing so many obscenities at you right now. That is fantastic.
It is so funny. Who knows if it happens, if it's going to happen or not. They apparently are talking to a few other people, but I did have my FaceTime interview with one of the producers yesterday. And my sense is that it went well. So we'll see what happens.
You're such a brat.
Oh, wow. Man, life is so funny and random.
Wow.
But with that,
Save me some cake.
Shouldn't it be Cake Judge?
Cake Judge,
oh.
Yes. That's a good point. I'll talk to them about relocating it to a different show.
Hmm.
Oh, Cake Boss. Hey, Boss Battle. Yeah. okay, it's a stretch. I'm sorry.
I do want to mention that Reed did quite a job of sort of his hardcover launch of American Survival Guide there as well.
And oh, yeah.
I ran a American game, as I mentioned briefly, but Reed goes all out. He got us t-shirts and of course we had the book, but he bought candies. He got warheads and these barrels of these sour candies called Toxic Waste. Now everybody at my table ate all the warheads, but nobody would touch the Toxic Waste. And when I asked somebody about it, they said, well, I wanted to try it, but somebody had one and he couldn't open his left eye for like 5 minutes. He just made this face and he couldn't open his left. And then I was like, I still have one barrel left sitting on my desk at work and I won't open it. I'm kind of looking at it going, maybe not.
Maybe well not. Played, Reed.
Anyway, sorry.
We were sad to miss it. I missed it more than I thought I would, to be honest.
It would have been great to have all you guys there, but, you know, there's always next year.
Well, and next year...
Yeah, I still haven't been to GameholeCon.
The dates were announced for next year. It's going to be the 8th through the 11th. Hmm. They had to bump it by a week for whatever, home football games or something.
Yeah.
The only way they could get decent hotel blocks is when the games aren't in town. So since it's actually over our anniversary and the hubby's birthday, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, whenever he listens to this.
There you go.
See if we can make something happen.
There you go.
That's great. All right. So I think we've had a good time here in the tavern. Let's head on over to the meat of our episode and go on over to summon email.
I call upon the flame to summon you.
Who delivered the message for me?
I came here to give you these facts.
Summon email.
Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night will keep us from reading these emails. So we've got quite a backlog in the mailbag here. It looks like we've got 21 emails. One of them dates back to June, our buddy Andrew, whose adventure we keep saying we'll read but didn't get around to. But most of them go back to about early August and then through the present day. So we'll see how many we can get to. We're going to try to get through them fast, but also not just, you know, completely skip over them. We probably won't get to all of them because we want to keep this episode to a nice, normal, healthy length. But we'll see how many we can get through. So, yeah, I kind of spoiled it that we'd be starting with Andrew Hay. But, Jen, do you mind reminding us what we're doing with that one?
Shall I read it really, really fast?
Yes, read everything really, really fast.
I enjoy the show. We at the Keep Studios recently published our first adventure module. There are more on the way. Please take a look and tell us what you think. And he gives us two links. So,
nice and fast. So, Julian.
It was brief, which was nice. You guys, this one's for you.
Yeah, Julian, what'd you think?
Well, I liked it quite a bit. It's a nice, it has a really, I felt like it had a really nice classic Appendix N type feel. Like, very sort of Conan wandering around in the jungle, looking for the lost temple, that sort of thing.
And the title is Sword in the Jungle Deep.
Yes, Sword in the Jungle Deep.
Thank you.
It's a funnel adventure, which I might have liked it a little better as a first level adventure, but
I would agree.
But I think you could run it as a first level adventure anyway. Most funnels you can run with first level characters. So I had the thought that if I was going to run it, I would probably use first level guys. But other than that, you know, I thought it has a little, you know, it has a wilderness portion, whereas you're kind of going through the jungle and, you know, fending off monsters and so on and exploring. And then it has a sort of a more classic dungeon crawl thing. So anyway, nice job, guys. I would say it has a great classic old school feel, and keep them coming.
Yeah, and I've definitely got thoughts about it as well. Starting with the art, I think the art on the inside is really quite lovely, and I especially like the cartography of the main map.
Oh, yeah.
It very much has the DCC vibe. The only nit that I would pick with the art is on the cover, we've got this like badass elf with her bow and arrow, and we've got this shirtless barbarian with his like loincloth and broadsword. And considering that this is a zero level adventure, I would have liked to have seen like a bunch of terrified villagers rather than some badass seasoned adventurers. But otherwise, I think the art is fantastic. In terms of content, I agree with you, Julian, completely. It has this really kind of like nice, pulpy Appendix N vibe to it. And one thing that really I thought was cute and clever and cracked me up is at the end of every single little block of text, every single little box text that you're supposed to read out loud, there's a little section that says TLDR for too long didn't read. And it just gives you some quick bullet points of what's actually in there.
Right.
And I thought that was really hilarious, really funny, and actually very clever and helpful, because I know that a lot of us don't read that flavor text at our table. And just kind of having
those paraphrase, yeah.
Yeah, and having those quick bullet points there are very helpful. Now, the one nit that I would pick about the actual content, though, is I feel like it's got two pages of background. And the background, in my opinion, was a little too long, didn't read, for my taste. Not that it's not fantastic, but it's just there's so much information. So I would have preferred either a shorter background, or if you could have done a too long, didn't read bullet point for the two pages of story background, that would have been very helpful for me. But otherwise, I think it's a fantastic adventure, and I'm really glad that you took the time to share it with us. So thank you, Andrew.
Onward.
Yes, onward. Julian, we've got a G+ community post in here for you.
Ah, indeed. All right. By Mr. Stephen Warble. Listening to another podcast, Spellburn for the Dungeon Call Classics, folks, and guest Edgar Johnson talks briefly about also running Spirit of 77, a Powered by the Apocalypse game, and what he sees as the similarity between OSR and story gaming play. As far as I recall, the hosts of Spellburn have shown a lot of positivity towards the greater gaming community, and except for a bunch of pokes at Pathfinder, that's me, don't promote that us versus them mentality that you get from some more traditional sections of the OSR. I just find it nice when the separate tribes of gamers talk nice about each other. I don't have much to say about that. Even I hope my pokes at Pathfinder, they're sincere, but they're not vengeful and vindictive anyway. So yeah, I think we try to take a positive approach to everything we do. I think that's true of the whole community, and that's what I like about DCC community. As far as the rest of the OSR, I see a lot of that, and when I don't see it, I just kind of move on.
Yeah, I'm kind of the mindset that it's such as the RPG community is really kind of such a small niche community to begin with anyways. So to kind of pick fights within it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. And also, I am an OSR player. I love DCC. I love Labyrinth Lord and Swords and Wizardry. But I also do enjoy story game stuff, too. I think Dungeon World is a lot of fun. I've had a lot of fun playing games like Fiasco. And I enjoy all kinds of styles of gaming, and I don't really, and even if I didn't, I don't fully understand the desire to tell somebody that they're having the wrong kind of fun. It doesn't make sense to me.
And now, in the spirit of disclosure, this came about, as you said, Julian, from the Gauntlet G+ community. The Gauntlet is another gaming podcast. They're predominantly all of OSR, and they were affiliated with some people holding a small online community that was trying to get some DCC judges in there. So we got to talking about DCC and the community as a whole, and this is one of the things that kind of popped out of it. So I made sure to snag it for our mailbag because it's awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome. Thank you, Jen, so much for including that.
And the honestly, all of the quote-unquote Mathfinder jokes, or I should say the majority of them, may have gone out with the old guard. So we'll see how things happen in the next few months.
That's true. And honestly, I think the Mathfinder jokes are fun and funny because, I mean, really, when Dungeon Crawl Classics was a brand new game and we were trying to figure out what it was, we were really kind of coming out from an environment where most people in our kind of hobby were playing games like Pathfinder. And really, we had to kind of identify what Dungeon Crawl Classics was in a lot of ways in comparison to Pathfinder. So it does kind of make a lot of sense to me why initially when the podcast started and when the game was new, that was kind of what the point of reference was. But I think we've kind of, as a community and as a gaming industry, have kind of moved past that point.
Yeah, honestly, it has to be us versus them or we're all screwed. So, okay, sorry.
Cool, no problem.
Awkward pause.
Excuse me.
I'm good at that. So, there's more in here.
There is. And we can't have a mailbag episode without DM Kojo.
Kojo!
Greetings, Spellburners. I wanted to share a few of my house rules and see what you thought of them. Number one, I allow clerics to get a bonus to their initial spells based on their personality modifier, like the rules allow for wizards and elves with their intelligence modifier. Number two, I do not allow warriors and dwarves to spend a luck point to avoid a fumble result. Number three, I do not allow wizards and elves to spend a luck point to avoid a corruption result. Number four, if a thief rolls a one on a thief skill check, I have that thief roll some kind of a fumble, like they step on a branch and make a lot of noise, or they break a lock, or trip a trap, etc. Number five, if a cleric heals a PC of an opposing alignment, it is an automatic plus one to their disapproval range. The book says that this can be considered a sinful act and leaves the consequences to the judge, so that's how I handle it. Burn on, DM Kojo. So, Jen, what do you think of these house rules?
Oh, Kojo, I'm with you about two-fifths of the way, man. Clerics, initial spells based on personality modifier? Yeah, sure, why not? Warriors and dwarves get to spend luck to avoid a fumble, usually. I would almost be okay with you preventing the dwarves from doing that, because they can't always catch their feet in time. But usually warriors have a little bit more practice at this. I kind of feel that might nerf them a little bit. But or I would even say if it's a one on both your D20 and your deed die, if you get the double ones, essentially like a halfling, I could totally see that, you know, sorry, dude, you actually fumbled. Wizards and elves, spending luck to avoid corruption. I'm on the fence. I could go with you on that one. I love the idea of thief fumbles on thief skill checks. And what was the last one? Cleric healing somebody of an opposite alignment. I think they're already penalized because the difficulty range is modified to account for that already. They should roleplay it if all else fails and start requiring tithes or donations to their god. Adding a point of disapproval in there is just an added smackdown, I think. And I think that might be a little too rough.
Great. Julian, what do you think?
Clerics getting a bonus to their spells. I don't really care. I think it's okay the way it is. Cleric spells stacking up tend to get pretty powerful. High level clerics have a lot of power. I don't really need to give them more power. It doesn't offend me.
Oh, that's true. They get lay on hands, too. So they already get an extra
It doesn't
thing.
Offend me, but I don't.
And turn unholy.
Number two, I think most my players never do this. I think we all forget that they can, so I don't really have any opinion. Number three, is wizards and elves spending. Don't allow wizards and elves to spend a luck to avoid a corruption result. My players also don't remember they can do this. Although when I playtested the mutant mashup, Dahlstrom was constantly taking corruptions to get more points on Spellburn and stuff, and it was cracking me up. So in a con game, people, if they do know the rule, they'll be taking more corruption rather than going the other way. Mm-hmm. If a thief rolls a one on a thief skill check, yeah, for sure I do this already. And in fact, I kind of try to do it for any saving throw or any skill check where you roll a one. I try to have it be a sort of in kind type of fumble. And five, Jenna, just all I can say is totally agree with you. Don't make it a mechanic. Make it part of the role play.
Yay! I like that. And Julian, I'm almost with you on every single one of these points. You know, number one with the clerics, with their initial spells, it's like, yeah, sure, if you want to, but they've got enough extra stuff. I don't think it's necessary. Two and three, my experience is that nobody remembers those rules, but even if they did remember them, I doubt I would let them use it, especially not a wizard or an elf using it to avoid corruption. You're getting that corruption. You've earned it.
Yes.
The thief rolls on a one. Yeah, if you roll a one on any kind of a skill check where there's a chance of it going horribly wrong, it's going to go horribly wrong at my table. And the one thing where I kind of have a slightly different opinion on is the cleric of an opposing alignment thing. You know, I feel like the opposing alignment, adjacent alignment, and same alignment mechanism for clerical healing in DCC is a little too fiddly, because it doesn't apply to the bless spell. You know, we don't have different effects depending on the alignment of the person when you cast the bless spell and things like that. So I personally feel like it's a little too fiddly. So when I run games with clerics, they all just check the exact same part of the chart. Like, it's always just adjacent for me. And really, they're only going to get deity disapproval if, you know, they're doing something. If you're healing somebody who's kind of is specifically doing things that your god is going to find distasteful, or if in the game it becomes clear that, like, every time you try to heal that person, if your spell keeps failing, then maybe your god doesn't want you to heal that person. And perhaps maybe I'll start giving you disapproval for successful healing of that person as well. Just kind of how it ends up unrolling in the story is how I'm going to roll with it on that.
Nicely put.
Thanks. So, Jen, let's head on over to our next email.
Crank out the next one. This one comes from Donnie Van Zant. Curious how you introduce a new character after the funnel. Do players randomly roll up an X-level character or roll several and pick the best? Seems a single character rolled post-funnel has a huge disadvantage since you only have one shot to roll stats. Thanks. Love the podcast. Wow. To introduce a new character after the funnel? I'm presuming you mean in campaign play? Okay. I have thoughts. I'll kick it to Julian first.
I totally believe you should give players the option of bringing in new zeros, like a squad of new zeros, or letting them have a character that is maybe the same level or one level down. In the old D&D days, if you joined a party late, I would always say you can roll a character starting experience, you know, lowest experience plus one of the level underneath the one level down from the average level of the party. And I, you know, that seems like a reasonable rule. I don't think there's any consideration to worry about having one shot to roll stats versus four shots to roll stats, because the one high level guy in the funnel never lives anyway. So it doesn't mean much to me.
Okay. Good point. So I played in a game that was run by my buddy Chris Wolf, and he's doing kind of a campaign sandbox thing, and there was no funnel. We all started out as first level, and you know, we weren't doing 46 drop the lowest. We weren't doing any kind of a Pathfinder point vice, speaking of Pathfinder. But what he did do is we could roll instead of 3d6, it was 3d5 plus 3. For our stats. And it was fun using the kind of the funky dice in order to do that.
That's
and
it clever.
Did generate, yeah, and it did generate higher, slightly higher results. And so it was 3d5 plus 3 down. And Chris, if you're listening and I'm misquoting how you did it, please forgive me. But I believe it was 3d5 plus 3 down the line, and then you could swap two stats. And I liked the way that worked in practice. And I think maybe if I were running a campaign where maybe everybody was like fourth, fifth, sixth level, and then one of their characters died, or we got a new player. You know, if everybody's kind of fourth, fifth, sixth level, it doesn't make sense to have the next person start off as a zero level character. You want to have somebody who's at least, you know, close to the party level. So I might consider doing something like that. I don't know. I'd have to be in the situation, but having played it that way, I did think that that worked well for what he was trying to accomplish.
Okay. Jen. My turn. I have thoughts. Yeah, in the earlier days of my campaign, when someone came in as a new player, they would get a pair of zero levels to fill out the table of eight or nine people who already had anywhere from level one to three. these days with higher levels in there, yeah, that does get to be a little bit more difficult. So I would probably just give them their choice of a pregen. If we were to start something new, which we've actually been thinking about doing as an open table game, if somebody wants to join the game that wasn't there before and is totally new to DCC, maybe we could arrange to be there an hour or two prior and run them through a small bit of encounter so that they at least get that funnel experience. Because I think that's really important with the initial building of a character, especially for roleplay and everything else. That way you've got something to bring to the game and to the rest of the table. And from there, level up to be, you know, in line or the same level minus one or something, like Julian was saying. If you've got a table of fourth levels, bring in something that's second or third so they can at least hold their own. But I like the idea of giving them at least a brief funnel experience first. And even then, you know, your favorite character is going to die. You just got to make peace with that, man.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next.
And also just real quick, I want to add a little quick postscript. I'm realizing that it is my friend Andrew Sternick for his campaign. We did 3D5 plus 3 down the line for his one. And what Chris Wolf had us do for his is we rolled 3D6 down the line, but we rolled it 7 times, dropped the lowest stat, and then swapped 2.
Wow, that's generous. That is very generous.
Well, that one still yielded lower results than the 3D5 plus 3. You get much more kind of heroic stats with 3D5 plus 3. But yes, the next one. So,
all right. From Professor M. Hello, judges. I've only recently started listening to podcasts, and I've been tearing through Spellburn. Keep up the good work. I've heard luck discussed several times on the show, and I have a comment to throw out. You mentioned luck rewards for adventurers causing a problem by creating higher-level characters with outrageously high luck score. Jen mentioned thieves and halflings with luck scores of 19+. I've taken a different approach to luck. Tell me if I'm doing it wrong. Luck is an ability score like strength or constitution. A wizard might burn points of strength to power a spell, but he's going to slowly gain that back. Or he might have restore vitality regenerated. However, he's not going to gain back more than he started with. Is luck not the same, barring some extraordinary circumstances? Page 19 describes spending and regaining luck. Luck may be restored over the course of their adventures. Restored, but not increased. Then in the judge's rules, page 360, the judge is encouraged to make a plot point of increasing character luck. Certain classic fantasy characters were known to be doomed as part of their role in a greater drama complex beyond their understanding, while others were repeatedly luckier than they should have been. Players can quest for a better luck score. I think that allowing luck rewards only up to your starting score encourages players to spend luck in the first place so they can gain it back after heroic adventuring, prevents the players becoming unable to fail, recovering the body checks, and so on, and then also can serve as an adventure hook. So go challenge the fates and permanently increase that luck score. Cheers, and may all your hits be crits, Professor M.
I think that's brilliant. And that's not how I've been playing it. I've been playing it the way that Professor M says that he's heard other people talk about playing it. But I actually think that you have convinced me, Professor M. I think I'm going to start playing the way that you propose. I like that quite a bit.
Okay, I have, in my defense, I will state that there are some modules out there from the earlier days of DCC wherein the authors actually recommend at certain plot points, like during the conclusions, if you will, to reward players or characters who have completed X goal by increasing their luck score by 1. And I will also state for the recovering the body checks, they have to roll under their current luck, not what their max would be. So if thieves have 18, 19, even 20 some points of luck and they've burnt it down to 6, that 6 is what they have to roll under to recover their own body. So there's a give and a take, and there are some things that I would certainly do different now from when I had started on the road crew. In fact, I'm going to probably go Fleeting Luck all the way, to be perfectly honest with you, taking the Lankmar suggestions. But yeah, the recovering the body checks, I just want to make sure that part's clear, that it is the current luck score that they have to roll under for that. So it shouldn't be a point of paranoia for a judge to worry about them having a max score that high, because chances are they're not going to have to try to recover their body at the very beginning of an adventure.
I think it's a great counter to luck hoarding. And I think I'm going to, I'm pretty intrigued by Fleeting Luck for my next campaign, but I would say that generally speaking, this makes a lot of sense as far as, you know, just not letting people rise above their luck score, or I might allow it, but if I did allow it, I would say those are essentially temporary luck that you have until you spend them, you know, maybe you have it for one adventure or something like that, but you don't permanently raise your luck score. They're like temporary hit points or a temporary strength increase or something of that nature. But generally speaking, in principle, I love it. And, you know, it's funny. I just had the thought as I was listening to you guys ponder it. It reminded me all these different little house rules and mutations and so on is kind of like D&D back in the day, because you would meet new D&D guys and you'd meet guys that you hadn't met before, that you hadn't gamed with before, and you'd talk about the rules. And of course, there was no internet. I mean, I'm talking way back, like in my high school era. And you'd actually have to share this wisdom across, you know, groups. And that's kind of how people learn to play the game, because otherwise you'd be wading through these 500 pages of Gygaxian contradictory stuff. And nobody really played with a lot of that stuff anyway. So now we're doing it in a 21st century way, but in a way we're still finding the same ways that we like to do things best and using that accumulated wisdom. It's kind of cool. So, sorry.
Yeah. And in addition to our 21st century ways, we're also all publishing our own house rules as our own little self-published game supplements, or creating whole new games from our house rules. So yeah, it definitely is like a whole new era of how we're presenting.
That's true.
Those.
My house rules are going to be DCC white, black, box, hack, and wizardry.
I fully support that. So we also have an email here from a Judge Roger. He says, "Fellow judges, longtime listener, first time emailer. I wanted to share some of my insight from running several DCC, fantasy, and Star Wars funnels at my friendly local gaming store, Cloud Giant. First, I had a stamp made up at Staples that just says dead. Then I stamped the dead character sheets with. These get hung on a pillar in the store."
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome.
"Second, I have the players play only one character at a time, and when that character dies, they use the next character of theirs. Third, whatever the seat layout is, that is the general marching order. So players close to the GM screen are up at the front in gameplay, usually being the ones to get attacked first. As players die, the player gets up and moves to the back of the line with their new character. This allows rotation of the players in the front, which I found helps people to pay attention and be more in the game. Thematically, it also makes sense. Question: how do you handle gods and deity requests in the campaign? Does the cleric just know what he has to do? Does the god actually speak to them? Or is it channeled through some other priest or text?" So, yeah, Jen, what do you think of about Judge Roger's way of handling his funnels and his questions about gods and deities?
Oh, I love hanging the character sheets on the pillar in the store. That is a thing of beauty. And I hope that they have dead characters from games of all genres hanging on that pillar. Playing one character at a time makes perfect sense. The marching order is intriguing and definitely keeps people on their toes, because they can't be lax and leaning back in their chairs on their phones and all that crap. That would actually be a godsend at sometimes. The gods and deity requests, I'm presuming he means more along the lines of a quest being sent down to them, in which case I usually use messengers of some sort, whether they're delivering a text or whatnot. But yeah, there's not a whole lot of... I have a problem with trying to wear too many hats already, and I've got to basically NPC all these patrons and all these deities. So I have to draw limits somewhere and, you know, find a little solace in being able to play a little kid who gets to skip down the lane and drop a note at somebody's feet.
That makes sense. Julian?
I would say that I try to have different ways of communicating during the campaign, you know, appropriate to the god or patron or what have you. However, I think I, in actual practice, I fall back to this sort of red-faced yelling thing where it's just kind of enjoyable. And so that's kind of, but sometimes I'll give the character a vision or he might have a dream where he's communicated with, or, you know, send a bird messenger and that kind of stuff. You know, there's so many, you can read Homer and so on for that sort of inspiration of how gods would appear. And sometimes they would just show up or whatever. I just wanted to mention that I think in our last episode, we talked about how the patrons didn't demand enough in return. From adventures, we got caught up in the mechanics and we didn't role play the thing. And so at GameholeCon, I said, you know what? I'm going to be a jerk. And my patrons are going to be jerks. My gods are going to be jerks. So I had two different tables where the cleric was of Cthulhu and they just randomly both pick Cthulhu. And Cthulhu was, more or less doing what a god should do for a cleric, but every time he berated them and told them they were insignificant and that their, you know, insect lives didn't make any difference to the greater forces of chaos that were beyond their comprehension and so on, he should have probably just made a bunch of squishing noises and stuff, but I didn't have anything. And then the other time I was, Hobbs was playing an elf who had a patron of Akroma, the Mutant Crawl Classics AI.
Oh.
And he was, as at the end of that adventure, they found four artifacts. They destroyed one trying to figure it out. So they had three left, and he had promised to Akroma to get three artifacts and give them to Akroma. So we didn't have much time, but I said, well, do you guys let the elf actually do this, or do you kill him and take the artifacts? And, you know, because he wasn't going to give up, and the patron demanded stuff. And so we had a fun little chat for the last 5 minutes about what they should do. That was, I had a good time with that. And I really want to keep doing that in all the games I run.
And did they suffer the elf to live?
They did.
Oh.
They went easy on him.
Okay.
He can be kind of a charming son of a gun when you I hate to admit it, but I think they just, his snake oil, they were just gobbling that up, you know?
So, taking a look at this email here, I've also got one of those dead stamps and I have a blast stamping those at conventions or at my meetup game. I do have a quick funny anecdote about it. So the one I have is the one that you often see floating around on the G+ community that just says dead and then underneath it cause of death. And there's a little blank spot where you can write in what the cause of death was. And it has that Doug Kovacs DCC skull on it. And when I ordered mine from Vistaprint. And as soon as I placed the order, I realized I had mistakenly placed the order with black ink. So instantly I called the customer service line and I was like, I just placed this order online. Is it too late to change it to red ink? And I've got the woman on the phone and she's like looking at my order. She's like, no, that'll be fine. We can make that change. And then there's this moment where she actually sees the image and she pauses for a moment and she says, oh, do you work at a funeral home?
Oh, my God. Oh, that is well worth it. Thank you.
Isn't that hilarious? But anyways, yes. So I do love the putting the dead characters on the pillar on the store. That's hilarious. I don't do the players one at a time thing. I think that could be fun. My only issue with that, I feel like with some funnels, it would be a hard time justifying why that other character just kind of appeared out of nowhere. But if you have the right kind of funnel for it, sure. Seating layout marching order thing is intriguing. I probably wouldn't do it for my games, but I think it would be fun to try it at somebody else's. I guess my main thing with that one is it's just kind of, if you've got all of your dice in front of you and all of your paperwork and like, and our DCC funky dice, they roll around so much, like it's hard to keep them in place anyways. So I feel like it might be kind of annoying to like be constantly playing, duck, duck, goose with your seating arrangement. But it's still an intriguing idea. As for handling gods and deity requests in our campaign, a lot of it depends on who the god is. You know, I've got a cleric of Babugbabills, and in my mind, since Babugbabills is both a patron and a god, whenever Andrew, who's playing Volrath, whenever Volrath summons or casts Divine Aid, sure, something that seems very much like Babugbabills or possibly is Babugbabills might appear. Because in my mind, since he's also a patron, he's a little bit more accessible. But if you're like a cleric of like Justicia or...
I wondered how long that was going to take.
Yeah, if you're a cleric of Justicia, I'm sorry, Justicia is not going to like... She's busy at her like, court in the heavens or whatever. And I don't really see her coming down in person to answer your divine aid or send you specifically on a quest. So that probably will come in the form of like, some kind of a dove with a message for you, or some kind of a crazy dream,
or the white.
Yes. Oh, I feel like the white would actually want to appear to you though. The white. Oh, but they're trapped underground. Yeah. Huh. But do we have
a vision of the white, or yes, a skull yes. pops up out of the ground and starts, blah, blah. I don't know.
Yeah, or it's like Justicia. What do you want with her?
Yeah.
They're corrupt.
All right, Jen, and we've got another little quick email here for you to take care of.
Okay. This one comes from simply another Judge J.
Mysterious.
And this mysterious missive includes about 3 pages of text. I'm going to paraphrase as best as I can. Greetings, Spellburned. I rolled a nat 20 on my Spellburn check. I got a 14 days for a total of 56 episodes. Been out of the loop for a bit, catching up on other games and shows, so here we go. This other Judge J starts with, all the way back at episode 47. This is the one where I was off, and our friend Judge Jarrett stepped in and talked with, I believe it was Julian and Job, that episode?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yes. So we've got a nice shout out to Judge Jarrett and playing at CantCon under Judge Panky. And this person plays a lot with Dr. Nathan Panky, which is kind of funny. Spellburn and Iron Tavern were this person's primer for running the game. They seem to have a different problem than the rest of us, where their players almost never spellburn or burn luck, but say that fleeting luck may cure one of these problems. I'm sorry, as a really cool girl on Twitch said the other day, there aren't enough cool chicks in gaming. Tell the ladies not to be intimidated and just jump in. I've run games with girls and women at almost every table since I started my term as a judge, and they range from 8 years old to this person's mother-in-law.
Whoa.
So it's just a matter of preference, I suppose. The thought of gaming with my mother-in-law. there's worse things, I suppose. One idea for Cody M. He was one of the people emailing us back on episode 52. Another Judge J recommends... this Cody is not comfortable with crowds, but wants to go to a small convention. Try CantCon in Kansas City. Taco John, Nathan Panky, and John Hook come almost every year. I know they aren't the Spellburn crew or the Dark Master, but it's a smaller con with about 400 people, lots of fun, good games, and everyone's really friendly. And,
cool. And CantCon, for those who don't know,
yes.
K-A-N-T-Con.
K-A-N-T-C-O-N, yes. And lots of different thoughts that I think we've emailed this person some responses to. Oh, wait, Jen, you asked for hate mail too. Here goes. I hate that you guys don't do AP.
Yeah, see?
There, Julian, are you happy? From the heart of the Black Temple, deep beneath the streets of Justice City, another Judge J. Now, there were, I believe, three full questions that we pulled out of the email to answer at the end of everything.
Okay.
Jen, why are your players frustrated by picking up funky dice? They started playing the game with funky dice. They have this thing called dodecahedron, and they complain about a D7. As a point of clarification, when they're brand new to role-playing, no, they don't. They don't even know what a D20 is, dude.
Yeah.
Gotta remember that part, too. Is there any chance that Manly Mike would do something with Squiggle, Squiggle, Squish, Squish, the Flying Spaghetti Monster? Now, for the life of me, I can't figure out where this came from, but it was episode 50, and anything could happen.
yeah, I don't remember that reference either.
That must have been when he was on talking about Lankmar, since uh-huh. Fleeting Luck came up there.
I know he likes Cthulhu.
And I know that deep down we're all Pastafarians.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you know, maybe. And the third question that we managed to extract was, Jen, you were talking about playing 40K. Have you tried Black Crusade yet? It can be a very amusing game and quite liberating as a player, too. Not Black Crusade, because it's kind of a big book of no, but I would say Dark Heresy. Anytime, any day, I will play the Seraphim Battle Sister. So I think that might be about it for this particular email.
I will say that I ran three sessions of Black Crusade. One was character creation.
Ooh.
And the next two, were actually pretty fun. And I got a great bunch of characters, Mark Woodhouse, Tim Mulry, John Carnes, my buddy Ian, and I don't know. Another fellow, Aaron, local guy. So anyway, we had a great time. However, it's really dense. It's just, wow. Great. I loved it because I really would love to have a system that does what that game does and just, but fun to play. So somebody out there will figure it out sooner or later. Okay, from Daniel Neugebauer, something like that. Hi, Spellburners. Congratulations for winning the Annie at Gen Con. Well-deserved, Smiley.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yay!
I've got a question about your campaigns in DCC. Do you use Aerith, Nawan, or a different campaign world? Maybe you did some world building before you started a campaign, or are you building the world along with the adventures? Thanks and greetings from Germany. That's a great question. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. The first one would be, I know there's this really cool game called Microscope. And if you don't know about it, Microscope is a world-building role-playing game. And basically, you and a group of people get around, and as you're playing the game, you're building a world. And I have met I've met several people who wanted to have DCC campaigns that they wanted me to be a part of and had proposed starting off the game with a session of Microscope.
I play that game all day.
I'm sure
right?
You do.
And I always lose.
Yeah.
I would say I don't think it's really appropriate to what I think of as the DCC vibe, because when I read the core book and it seems like the vibe of DCC is very much that nobody knows what is beyond the next hill. You know, you were raised in this small little village. You don't know what's 20 miles away from you. Everything is a mystery. And, you know, having just recently reread Eyes of the Overworld by Jack Vance, one of my favorite parts of it is that as Kugel is traveling through the world, every time he comes to a new village, the people are hardly aware of what even existed in the previous village. And I think that's really kind of fun and interesting. And you can do a lot of kind of massive world building in advance, but I think DCC thrives better when you don't and when you kind of allow the world to kind of come out through emergent gaming together. What do you guys think?
I am almost 100% on board with that. I mean, the basis for any quote-unquote world was stringing together DCC modules. And when a third-party thing came out, the landscape took a dramatic change. So
yeah.
There's no such thing as a map that you get ahead of time. Absolutely, positively, no. I don't care whether you're in the on the Purple Planet or in the Shudder Mountains. Yeah, the Shud folk kind of know some of the trails, but you as Zero Levels don't. You haven't been around for all those ages, you know, with all the trade routes and whatnot. I would say Nawon's a completely different story, because there you're talking about the urban adventuring, and that is a lot different. There are still a lot of nooks and crannies and alleys that you might not be aware of, but for the most part, if you spend any amount of time there, you're going to start to know the layout. You're going to know that, you know, Blood Street crosses with, you know, Gate Street or whatnot. My apologies if I'm in completely wrong quarters here, but, you know, just grasping at straws for names of streets. But you're going to get the names of streets. You're going to understand that, the River Quarter is the one by the main gate. The Crafts Quarter is over here. The Richmen's Quarter is, of course, outside of both of these. So you would have kind of a city map, per se. But once you leave the gates, all bets are off. There's no world map.
Exactly, which is why I think the Linkmar box set makes so much sense for Dungeon Crawl Classics, because I don't think there's anything about Dungeon Crawl Classics that doesn't say you can't have a city mapped out. Why not? And you can go ahead and throw Linkmar into any world that you've built for yourself. Or if you do want to play it in Nawon, my impression is that the Linkmar box set is not going to map out every section of Nawon and have like a massive sandbox of where every single city within Nawon is located and where the encounters are. That's still completely up to you to explore through your gaming.
And there are randomizers for those as well.
Oh, interesting.
So it's not up to you to have all of this ahead of time.
Oh, cool. What do you think, Julian?
Yes.
I love that. I have also literally just finished reading Eyes of the Overworld, a.k.a. Kugel the Clever.
And, yay!
Oh, it's one of my absolute favorite books. And Jack is, of course, probably my favorite Appendix N author. But the best part, just exactly as you said, Jeff, all these little villages and outposts and ruin, you know, people just living in haunted ruins, and they have no idea what's over the hill. And yet they all speak the same Vancian legalese. It's so awesome. It's just, which is a worldview, right? Like, of course it's so weirdly unrealistic, and yet it's actually completely Vancian worldview writ large.
Why have you chosen to slay me?
It is not that your life inconveniences me, but I do require sustenance, you know? So anyway,
because every villain has to have the monologue, right?
Oh, no, it's not a monologue. It's just very clipped, you know, very formal, reserved, aloof types of responses to. Anyway, yes. I have, I've really only run two major campaigns in DCC, and I put them in the same world. Which I just created basically by drawing some really vague stuff in a notebook for like geographical and topographical, you know, symbols. And then I wrote like very transparently ripped off from Midwestern beer brand type things, like, you know, like the Northeast Mountains and the Grain Belt River or something like that. I don't know. So because that's not really that important. And, you know, after that, I have had it be pretty emergent. And then when I felt like playing a module in a, you know, one of these locations, then I just put it in there and it fit more or less just fine. You know, stuff that was supposed to be out at sea, when they're inland, instead it's at a giant, like, freshwater Great Lake or something, you know, and it works just fine. So, yeah, that's what I've enjoyed. But I've also... sooner or later, I'm going to do the Purple Planet. And right now, I'm doing a Ravenloft game, so who the heck knows? I mean, yeah, I like playing some of that stuff, too.
Perfect. So I think that's going to be our last email for this segment of our episode. I think we did pretty good. Our next segment, we're going to still be able to address two more of them. So ultimately, by the end of this episode, we will have gone through 10 of our 21 emails. So we will be halfway through our email bag. So while it's still pretty hefty, we've made a nice big dent in it. So let's go ahead and head on over to Dungeon Denizens, where we will explore another pair of emails.
Go on, boss, chop his head off.
Right, silly little speeder.
Jesus Christ! I warned you!
My armor is like tenfold shields. My teeth are like swords. My claws, spears!
Here we are in Dungeon Denizens, and we have two emails here from Tom Wendt. The first one was kind of an early draft of it, and then a couple of weeks later, he sent us a follow-up. And Jen, do you want to read us this follow-up to his original email, where he kind of lets us know about this little critter he created?
Sure. This is from Tom Wendt. Hey, Spellburn Gang. I really enjoy listening to your broadcast. I started the adventure when I saw dice, graph paper, and pencils at a school library table in 1978, and really appreciate your old school spirit. I wanted to submit a little creature called a dreadnought, based on the giant kites I've seen at Huntington Beach. It's conjured by some wizard using dust, cobwebs, lint, and a brass medallion with an eye on it. Since he has fleshed it out in its entirety in the second email here, he's included some images for us to use. Just so you guys are aware, they include sketches and the finished product of a paper mache model that he has made of this.
Awesome.
Amazing.
And
so
it
cool.
is gorgeous. So we have the final product usually found in a pile of dust. Anyone touching the amulet, which bears an eye on it, will have a sensation of panic and have to resist the desire to flee uncontrollably. If they fail their save, a dust devil will rise from the dust, form into the creature, and pursue the character, or NPC, until they are successful in their saving throw, at which point the creature will have to leave and search for another. For each round the victim fails their save, they lose... Oh, shame on you. DCC stats, man. They don't have comp points. They lose stamina temporarily, and continue running uncontrollably until they reach zero, where they then curl up into a ball with only reviving with, you know, full stamina restored after 24 hours of rest. So if the dreadnought is encountered in its physical form, looking like some giant dusty cornucopia laying on the ground, if the players approach its closed eye, they'll have the same panic experience when the eyelid opens when they're looking at it. And attacks on the dreadnought will cause it to sink down, and when killed, it will revert to a pile of dust, cobwebs, and lint with an amulet buried inside. And it seems to sense the character with the weakest stamina, so this is a bane to wizards as a general rule. It's rumored that a clever wizard could use the amulet as a trap for other wizards, or to fling the amulet from a container to cause real problems for anyone else who picks it up, or for a person with just a general weak constitution, you know, cause them to panic just at the sight of it. So, yeah, this one is really fun, and the visuals really, really make it. Mm-hmm. Just something out of dust and cobwebs and lint, and as it turns out, paper mache. So,
very, very cool.
And we haven't had a Dungeon Denizen for so, so very long. But yeah, I think it's time, especially with us doing the contest with submissions to go with Stefan Pogue's art. Yeah.
And speaking of which, Julian, do you want to let us know where we're at with that?
Yes, we have a not a huge, but a really high quality group of submissions, happy to say. And we have not all finished poring over them, but we will, I think we should have that well in hand for episode 61. We will announce a winner and we'll post it on the Dungeon Denizen page. And I know it hasn't got a lot of love lately because we've been kind of ignoring it since Manticrex. But of course, Stefan's awesome pictures there, which is part of the contest. But by all means, you know, if you're a newer listener or whatever, or just want to reminisce, go back and see the Wampler and the Toadlock and some of the older denizens are a hoot. I was just going back and reviewing some of that stuff, and it was pretty fun. So have at it.
And I absolutely love that this guy not only provided a sketch of his critter, but photos of what it looks like in the process of and the completion. So
for the next Dungeon Denizen, we want you to show us a tattoo that you've given yourself of the Dungeon Denizen. Possibly you and your family cosplaying as the Dungeon Denizen.
And for that tattoo, you better have crafted that ink yourself, mister.
And just in case it isn't clear, the submissions for Stefan's Dungeon Denizen is now closed. So we have received all of our submissions, but we will go ahead and announce the winning one on the next episode, which you did point out, Julian. I just wanted to make it clear that we are no longer taking submissions, though.
Yeah, correct.
Now, that's right. Not to say you can't still email something in for the Dungeon Denizens page.
Please.
It just has to have its own art.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're
pretty pleased.
I think we may have a reverse denizen where we get somebody smart to write a monster and then see if the artists want to draw him.
Sneaky idea.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yay.
Great. Well, guys, that's our episode.
Already?
I think that's it. Already, I know.
Will Cezricon be pleased with our paltry efforts?
he's moved on to whiskey by now, I think.
Well, guys, thank you for helping me get through this this big old mailbag here. We've still got quite a few left, but like we've got a lot accomplished this week.
That's
got
true.
A lot of big ones out of the way too.
Yes, we did. No doubt about that. So everybody, thank you for listening. And if you want to, you can send us an email at theband@spellburn.com. You can go ahead and help us fill up our bag once again. And do you guys have any parting words for our listeners?
Game on, and hope to see the locals in the Upper Midwest at Con of the North in Feb. Make plans now.
Perfect. And Jen?
Have a great night, everyone. And if all else fails, we will see you at GaryCon.
Later, Gators.
You've been listening to Spellburn. Copyright 2017. Theme song has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. Learn more at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com.